Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on Saturday, March 14th, 2020. This is the eighth Saturday class of our 12-week Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. This class is on dependent origination. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So a few more folks have joined us online. It looks like there's seven or eight of you. Most of our Sangha is practicing, what's the word now? Social distancing. Yes, very good. We're in the eighth week. It's actually the second class of our eighth, I should call it the eighth chapter on Understanding Not Self, which is a chapter on dependent origination. Let me just figure out which mic that is. Could you all mute your mics, please? Here it is. Where was I? The eighth week. There's actually four classes, and the eighth chapter is going to be taught over 2 weeks. So we started last Tuesday with the first talk on dependent origination. And for those of you that are reading the book, I probably read about a quarter of this chapter and commented on it. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit for a second talk on dependent origination. And then next week, there'll be two talks on the five clinging aggregates. Let me just read this, but just to put in context where we are in our study, we started with jhana meditation, our first class, which was just a review of the technique, basically. The next week was on the four foundations of mindfulness, where the beginning portion of that is the Buddha's instructions on what to do during meditation. The next week we looked at the Four Noble Truths, which is the context for everything that the Buddha taught. And then we spent 3 weeks, I think, on the Eightfold Path, the different factors of the Eightfold Path. Which brings us to this chapter, Understanding Not Self. And the reason why I titled the chapter that way is that dependent origination describes the formation of a fabricated self rooted in ignorance. And the second half of this chapter, the five clinging aggregates, describes the ongoing personal experience of suffering. So I'm jumping ahead. I think I'm about halfway through the chapter, and we're still on dependent origination. My words here: life in the phenomenal world is often experienced as arbitrary and personal, while at the same time predetermined and unavoidable. Dependent origination explains the process of the formation of a personality, a self, and the process of maintaining the self. That's kind of an important line there, because we're the ones doing the forming of an ego personality. We take the ego personality as the sum and substance of a self, when in fact that entire ego personality is a fabrication. It's not based at all in reality. And that is the reason why we create so much stress and suffering in our lives, because we've created a self that simply doesn't fit into the world that we created it for. And that'll be more understandable in just a moment. Dependent origination also explains the impermanent environment in which the distraction of dukkha arises and the steps necessary through heightened wisdom, heightened virtue, and heightened concentration to refine thinking and reverse the formation of an ego personality. Heightened wisdom, heightened virtue, heightened concentration refers to the Eightfold Path. Dependent origination is the Buddha's teaching on how personal phenomena arises within the environment of anicca, of impermanence. And when looked at correctly, there's nothing in the world that we can see as personal, as having any component of a me except that which we attach to impersonal objects, events, views, and ideas. The entirety of the Dhamma is to bring understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It is within the context of the Four Noble Truths that understanding of dependent origination develops. It means that wherever we are is where we develop the Dhamma. And the reason why I'm saying that is much of modern Buddhism, and truly much of most religions and spiritual systems, the focus is how to establish yourself outside of your body, outside of time, outside of what's occurring, and manufacture in your own mind a reward based on something you might be doing now. It's all based on speculation, isn't it? It's all based on a view rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so no matter how altruistic our fabricated beliefs might be, there's no reward at the end. The only reward is constant stress and suffering from living a life rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha teaches the Dhamma that the reward is understanding who we are in relation to the world we're living in. And by doing such, we maintain a calm and peaceful mind and are present for every moment of our life as our life unfolds. That is what brings great meaning and purpose to a human life, not living in a fabrication. Understanding dependent origination brings awareness of the relationship between the five clinging aggregates and the phenomenal world. The five clinging aggregates are physical and mental factors that cling together to form a personality identified as self. And next week we'll be talking more about this. Dependent origination explains the 12 causative links that determine the experiences of the ego personality. In other words, a human being is going to have a life. If we're born, the Buddha teaches the first noble truth is dukkha occurs. It occurs as a consequence of having a human life. It's not punishment. But if we're going to have a human life, which we are, if we're here, we're having a human life. We don't have any choice save suicide. If we're here, we're here. And if we want to get the most out of our life, it makes sense that we would understand who we are in relation to that life we're living. That's the great breakthrough of understanding that the Buddha discovered. Everything else, all the spiritual systems of his time and our time are taught as an escape from this human reality in one way or another, rather than this direct and very intricate explanation of what's occurring right here and right now, and how to understand it, how to experience it, how to actually be present for all the stress and suffering and all the wonder and beauty of having a human life. And we have to accept the first if we're going to have the second. It's all part of having a human life, and it's all impersonal. It's our relationship with what's occurring that makes it stressful and distracting and leads to further pain and suffering and further distraction. In the Paticca Samuppada of Abhanga Sutta, the last word of Abhanga is not usually used, but that's the official name. I don't usually use it myself too, but it's the Paticca Samuppada of Abhanga Sutta is the same as the Paticca Samuppada Sutta. And Abhanga is a difficult to, like most Pali words or Sanskrit words, to accurately translate because it can have so many meanings. In this meaning, Vibhanga simply means the overarching presentation of dependent origination. The Buddha taught dependent origination in many different suttas, and some of them only have 9 links. But when you look at, and I'm not going to get too deep into the why, but when you look at the context of that particular sutta, the 9 links relate to it. You'll understand the 12 links in just a moment. The Buddha presents the 12 causative links of dependent origination. Each of these 12 links are required to cause the self to experience confusion, disappointment, sickness, old age, death, and rebirth. The first, the Buddha's words, from ignorance as a requisite condition come fabrications. These are the Buddha's words. These aren't his exact words. These are from the Paticca Samuppada Sutta. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. This is not a statement by the Buddha saying that as human beings, we are basically just ignorant. What the Buddha is talking about, and this is why immediately the teachings point us to the importance of context. Because without context, that's what we're all going to assume. Oh, the Buddha just thinks we're a bunch of ignorant fools. In the context of the Buddha's Dhamma, what the Buddha is referring to, obviously, is ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So I'm going to say it that way. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths, as a requisite condition, come fabrications. As a requisite condition. Without that requisite condition, there is no fabrications. A fabrication, we had a series of classes on what fabrications exactly are, but fabrications are basically a corruption of what's occurring right now. Or Tanasarabhika uses the word perversion, which is a nice strong word to describe what a fabrication is. It's a perversion of reality. And perversion really relates to that, doesn't it? Because it implies the grasping and craving after that creates these fabrications in the first place. And it's a grasping or craving after a fabricated self that once it's established, that human being is compelled to keep the fabrications going or the whole house of cards falls apart. And that's where all the stress and suffering comes from. We know that we've done this to ourselves. But it's the nature of ignorance to ignore its own ignorance. It's in the word, isn't it? It's the nature of ignorance to ignore its own ignorance. And so we create these very powerful but very subtle strategies to maintain this ego personality, anatta, in a world that cannot support it, and yet we continually strive to do that, to do so. We spend from birth to grave doing that one thing, maintaining a fabricated self. And it's why, no matter what we experience in life, there's ultimately disappointment. Because even the things that we develop or acquire are rooted in impermanence, and so will bring disappointment. The only resolution to that is to understand that process. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes fabrications. From those fabrications leads to all the rest of this stress and suffering. And I'll explain that. This is the 12 links. From those fabricated views of self, from fabrications as a requisite condition, comes consciousness. Excuse me. And here it's important to point out one of the biggest misunderstandings in modern Buddhism, and I would say in the pop culture understanding of what the Buddha taught. In general, the Buddha never taught creation or any type of creation myth, even though most of modern Buddhism rests in that one fabrication. And that creation myth is attributed to what I'm reading here, to dependent origination. And there's nothing, when you hear the whole thing, there's nothing in the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta or any other teaching that the Buddha ever gave that teaches creation or includes a creation myth, meaning it explains where we come from. One of the most common misperceptions of dependent origination comes from something the Buddha never taught, which is the Abhidhamma, the third section of the Pali Canon. And that's where mostly Theravadins fabricated what the Buddha taught to justify their own need for a magical and mystical type of Buddhism. And so when you read the Abhidhamma, you can see where the creation myth attributed to dependent origination came from. It makes no sense. The Abhidhamma is just a ridiculously complicated and fabricated read that has no basis at all in reality, has no basis at all in what the Buddha taught. But in there, it teaches that, and I can't even explain it, even though I've read it 100 times, that the phenomenal world came into being over a series of 3 lifetimes. Immediately, that makes no sense, does it? But that's basically what it says. And the formation of the self occurs over those 3 lifetimes, resulting in a situation that we cannot extricate ourselves. The only thing we can hope for at that point is escape from to some other destination, meaning get out of the human life. And so when you look at it that way, you can see how the Buddha's Dhamma was corrupted to support fabricated dharmas. This is the one sutta that all the fabrication that has developed and called Buddhism is rooted in a corruption of this initial sutta. And this is what the Buddha awakened to. So that last line, from fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness, points to what I was just saying. Many people today hear that word consciousness and immediately go to this idea of a consciousness with a big C, meaning a grand cosmic consciousness, this grand cosmic consciousness that holds all of creation within its one thing. It's sometimes called unity consciousness or one mind consciousness. That whole notion contradicts everything the Buddha taught. The Buddha did not teach to see everything as one collective mass of whatever we might want to call it. That's a perfect explanation or perfect description of clinging, isn't it? We're clinging everything to this one amorphous form and saying, that's creation, that's me, that's life. And in so doing, we don't have to take responsibility for anything, do we? Especially the way I'm thinking right now, because I'm just one part of this one big collective mind that's now influencing me. And maybe I'm influencing it. What an awful thing to teach people, isn't it? That you don't have any mind of your own, because that's what that teaching is. The Buddha taught to see everything in its discreteness, especially human beings. We are all individuals. And as such, as individuals, we're the ones that create all the stress and suffering in our lives or all the beauty and wonder and peace in our lives. It's up to us. It's not up to outside conditions. It's not up to the newest virus that's chasing around. It's not up to anything. except how I think about myself in relation to the world. And this is a good example of that right now, what's going on right now, and all the fear that's coming up because we're losing our minds over what's going to happen to me rather than actually seeing things in reality. I'm going to mention, and I might even kind of fit it in here, the Kalama Sutta, because that's such a perfect sutta in relation to what's occurring right now and dependent origination. And again, I don't want to get into that teaching, but I might teach that in a week or so just to fit it in, because it is so important. But briefly, the Kalama Sutta is the Buddha's teachings to a group of people that are freaked out by the sickness that's spreading throughout their area of the world. And the Buddha says, take care of your practical needs, clean yourself well, wash your hands, don't touch your face, and take to the Dhamma. Because then you'll be able to make practical and reasonable decisions about what's best for you and everyone else. Let me get back to this. So from that, fabrications as a recognition comes consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, not some grand cosmic consciousness. It's just consciousness that is rooted in that ignorance and must change if it's going to extricate itself from that ignorance. From that consciousness, as a requisite condition, comes name and form. The Pali word for name and form is nama-rupa, but that's what it means, name and form. It means I have given a name to this form. That's all it means. And again, you look at the explanations of nama-rupa, and it makes no useful sense. Nama means name, rupa means form. So we're just using, when we're using the Pali word, we're just saying this. I have self-identified with this. I've made this me. And as soon as we do that, then look at the progression from ignorance of Four Noble Truths comes a fabricated view of who I am in relation to the world. That fabricated view is now informing or driving my consciousness, the way that I'm thinking, rooted in that initial ignorance. And from that way of thinking, from a way of looking at myself in relation to the world that's rooted in ignorance, I am creating a self and giving that self a name. This is now John. But because all of my beliefs are rooted in ignorance, any way that I interpret what's occurring to me is rooted in that ignorance. There's no reality in it. And this doesn't mean that I create, how do I explain this? It doesn't mean that I'm creating a fairy tale life. It simply means that I'm creating a fairy tale in my mind about life. Do you see the difference? It's like understanding that you're watching a cartoon rather than thinking that the cartoon is real. We think the cartoon is real. Why? Because we wrote the cartoon. We made it. We did it ourselves. And the Buddha understood that. And I won't teach it right now, but in the Nagara Sutta, that's what the Buddha described. This Nagara Sutta is a sutta where the Buddha describes his own awakening process, recognizing that feedback loop he created within himself of fabricated ideas stuck in this ignorant loop. A mind rooted in ignorance is compelled to ignore its own ignorance. There's something that's required outside of that, not outside of our own life, but outside of that way of thinking that directs our thinking towards recognizing it. That's the sole purpose of the Eightfold Path, to see what we're doing to ourselves and then to develop a way of living peacefully in the world. From that self-identification, from name and form as a requisite condition, comes the sixth sense base. Again, look at the brilliance of what the Buddha is teaching. Every human being has a sixth sense base, the five physical senses and the sixth sense of that consciousness that's referred to, consciousness rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And again, look at the progression. I've gone from ignorance of Four Noble Truths to making the fabricated views of myself in relation to the world real. That's created a way of thinking that's rooted in that fabrication, and now I've self-identified with that world. Now, because everything is now, I've just personalized my life. That's the process of personalizing things, giving a name to the form. This is me. Now, because of that self-identification and the way that human beings live in the world, everything that I come in contact with is feeding the fabrication. Meaning that now I am now interpreting what I'm coming in contact with through my sixth sense base, through what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, what I'm smelling, what I'm touching, what I'm thinking, what I'm tasting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And even something as impersonal as a taste, even though we obviously personalize taste, something as impersonal as a taste, we are going to make it personal. We're going to say, I like this, I don't like that. The same thing with what we're seeing. I like this, I don't like that. You think about something as ridiculous as being prejudiced against other people because their skin color is different than yours. When I was a kid and I didn't know anything about racism and how it develops, It was just ludicrous to me that we would think that way. But yet we do, don't we? And we've been doing it since the beginning of humankind. It's not something new. We're not racist in the 20th century. We've been racist since we've been human population. But it's all rooted in that ridiculous view that the way I see myself in relation to the world is the only view, and anything that's different from that is a threat. Well, I take things as a threat because what I've created is threatenable. It's like foam, as a Buddhist describes, it's like foam on the ocean. There's nothing here. Yet I've created this permanent self, and I'm bringing it out into this cruel world and saying, don't touch me, don't hurt me, don't do anything to me, don't take anything away from me. But what is that, what is that rooted in? It's rooted in ignorance. It's rooted in acquisition. It's rooted in thinking I need something more to be happy and healthy in the world. What I was created as is simply not enough. And the Buddha teaches that too, wouldn't you know? In the Dhatuvibhanga Sutta, the Buddha teaches that every human being can be this and only this. The four elements is called the sixth property person. The four elements, earth, wind, fire, and water. The fifth property of the space. Those four elements need something to manifest within. And the sixth property, going back to that consciousness. Ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of four noble truths. That is all any human being can ever be. No matter what we do with our life, no matter what we acquire, or no matter what we might not acquire, we cannot change that sixth property person. That's all we can ever be. But we can decide how we're going to experience our life as that sixth property person. That's the choice that we have in each and every moment. And so am I going to live my life as a sixth property person in peace and equanimity and understanding? Or am I going to continue to go against my own grain and insist through Namarupa, through self-identification, that what I've created is me, but what reality states it is isn't me? Because that's what we're doing. And the Buddha, again, the Buddha realized that, and he taught a way to flip that equation. To have the same life, the same human body, the same human mind, but live life in reality. To let go of all those fabricated views. And here, dependent origination explains how that process began in ignorance and where it takes us to. So, excuse me. Our minds are rooted in ignorance. And that is the defining view. That's called a wrong view. And this relates directly to the first factor, the Eightfold Path, right view. In order to go from this self-referential wrong view, we have to understand the process so that we can undo it. And that's what the Buddha is describing here. So again, just to emphasize that point, my mind rooted in ignorance of what's really occurring and interpreting what's occurring through that sixth sense base, and so informing my ongoing consciousness, the sixth base, the sixth part of that sixth sense base, with those continued wrong views, I can only continue my own ignorance. But once I start recognizing that, I can undo it. This continues with the formation of stress and suffering. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. From that sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. It makes sense, doesn't it? It has to be. I have to have something to interact with in the external world. But again, the Buddha's being a little bit intricate here so that we can understand the process as it occurs. It's not just being a lump of humanity that things are happening to us. There's a process in each and every moment that we are in complete control of. If we have a well-concentrated mind and understand how to see the things that we are in complete control of, unless we decide to give up control and live in a fabricated view. From ignorance comes fabrications. If I can find a way to recognize and abandon those fabrications, then I will stop feeding my senses from a fabricated view. And so this is, the entire 12 links are critical, but this is the point of manifesting, of the manifestation of ignorance in our lives. It's right here. This is where it's occurring. From that consciousness as a requisite condition, from ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of four noble truths, this relates to what I just said, comes feeling. We define ourselves by how we feel, don't we? And if I'm defining myself by how I feel in relation to thinking that is rooted in ignorance, what will I do? I can only fabricate on top of the feeling that itself is fabricated. This gets into that feedback loop. All that I'm doing is keeping myself imprisoned in my own views. And once I decide that my views are now the right view, even though the Dhamma teaches us that they're completely fabricated views, they're wrong views, because they're mine, I'm not going to let go of them. The only stress that comes from Dhamma practice is the stress of letting go of fabricated views. Yet many, many people cannot do that one thing. The Buddha described teaching the Dhamma for those people with just a speck of dust in their eyes, meaning people that are very close to understanding and just need to be aware, need the little push from the truth to overcome that. And that's just the way it is. It's not right or wrong. It's not that there's some people that just won't get it. There are some people that just won't get it. That's the first noble truth. The Buddha didn't see himself as a savior. He didn't teach a salvific religion. For just that reason, if he saw himself as a savior or hoped to teach a salvific religion, it would completely deny four noble truths, wouldn't it? Of course, the Buddha saw the reality of that. He didn't see himself as a savior. He saw himself as a teacher to those willing to learn how to live in this life. Period. That's all he wanted to teach. But when you understand it, what more could you want than to understand who you are in relation to the world you're living in? It changes everything. It makes each and every moment meaningful. It makes each and every moment poignant when you understand it. I was just speaking with someone. I won't get too deep in it because it might be personal if I explain the story. Once we're at that point, there's nothing that we have aversion to because we understand aversion is the most foolish thing we can ever develop. And I'm not talking about practical aversion, like don't kiss people with the coronavirus. Fabricated aversion, living in fear, kind of what's occurring right now. We live in reality. And because of that, there's no fear. We're able to be present for each and every moment of our life. And then if that moment doesn't include winning the lottery, it doesn't matter. Because winning the lottery and having a cup of tea are the same thing. Winning the lottery and having an argument with someone is the same thing. Winning the lottery and hearing that you're very, very ill with something is the same thing. Meaning it's the same experience. You experience these things with a mind of equanimity. It's just what's occurring. And if you haven't experienced it, and many, many people, it doesn't take a culmination of the path to have these experiences. Many of you online, I tend to talk out to the group that's here, but there's more people online this morning, have had that experience of life in this moment is just the way it is. And that's wonderful. But it's not an exaggerated or exciting feeling. So it takes a well-concentrated mind to understand, yeah, right now I'm okay. I'm actually enjoying this life. I'm at peace with what's occurring. This is meaningful. This cup of tea or this sniffle is meaningful. Why? Because I'm having it. It's not because it's the most expensive cup of tea or the rarest or anything. I'm enjoying this cup of tea because I'm enjoying this cup of tea. It's what I'm doing right now. I'm enjoying my life right now because I'm enjoying this class and I'm enjoying teaching this class. You all are enjoying this class because you're wowed by what's occurring in this class. We're present for life as life occurs. Everything is meaningful. Now, going back that one, from contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. If I'm judging everything by how things are making me feel, I've lost my mind, haven't I? Because controlling our mind is controlling the way we feel, controlling things that happen. I don't lose my mind because of the feeling that it engenders, do I? I understand feelings are impersonal. So they don't drive the way I am living in this moment. It doesn't alter my calm and peaceful mind or what I'm being mindful of. I'm not distracted by what I need to get out of what I'm feeling right now or distracted by getting more of what's making me feel so good right now. I'm simply in this moment. Is everybody getting that? I can't ask folks online because I muted there. And just think about that for a moment, because this is one of those things that I think is most remarkable that I missed for the first half of my life, or maybe more than that. It's how remarkable each moment is when I don't want it to be different. But if I do want it to be different, meaning I need more or less of something in this moment, this moment is lost, isn't it? No matter what's occurring, no matter what it is. And so there's no practical living in this moment if I need this moment to be different. But if I can learn the radical acceptance that Siddhartha Gautama realized then each and every moment is meaningful. I think I've said that about 6 times this morning, but that's the point. Everybody's looking for meaning in life. We all are. We just don't understand how to get it. Many people believe that meaning comes from getting the biggest pile of gold. They used to say the biggest pile of coconuts in our hut. We think that's meaningful. Or having the most prestigious position, being president or a senator, or something else that is a position of power. We think that's a way of establishing ourselves in the world. Excuse me. Many people think that if I could just have that one good relationship, that's what I need to be happy. And people spend their whole lives chasing the one relationship, going from one to another to another. Why? Because they're disappointing. And other people will disappoint us. Not in a personal way. Other people will disappoint us because they're other people, aren't they? And I'm not in control of other people. The only thing I can learn to control is the way that I think about myself in relation to the world. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. Again, think of it, it makes perfect sense. For me to crave anything, I have to feel that I need it in this moment. If that process that we're talking about is not rooted in ignorance, if I have an understanding of Four Noble Truths, I never get to this point of feelings driving craving and clinging, do I? I have interrupted it at the point of contact. Do you get that, Ram?
Oh, yeah.
This is something that I talk about a lot. This is where, again, I'm coming back to this in different ways. The Dhamma is practiced right here, right now, at the point of contact. And dependent origination describes that. As I'm coming in contact with the world, the people and events of the world, I'm interpreting it through the sixth sense base. And if that consciousness is rooted in ignorance, I can only interpret it towards more ignorance. If that thinking is rooted in the wisdom developed through the Eightfold Path, then in this moment, I can continue to incline my mind towards awakening. And for the most part, this moment will be peaceful, or it won't cause me to lose my mind forever and ever. In other words, in the moment, I might lose my mind. I might react in an ignorant way. But because I now have the framework of the Dhamma, and we talk about this all the time, in this moment, while dependent origination is unfolding towards more ignorance, I can do what? I can take a breath, bring my mind back in my body, unite my mind in my body, and start thinking clearly. How do I start thinking clearly? By changing my thinking from a fabricated view to a view that's framed by the Eightfold Path, framed by reality. This is how the Dhamma works. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. So once I've decided something makes me feel good, it alleviates the immediate problem of me not feeling safe and secure or fulfilled in this moment, not disappointed, not dissatisfied with what's occurring. Then I'm going to attach myself to that, because now I think that it's the second piece of chocolate cake that did it for me. The first one wasn't enough. But boy, I feel good after the second. I'm describing the progression of addiction, whether it's to drugs, alcohol, food, sex, golf, TV, Facebook, anything else. That's how it happens, because something makes us feel good or it resolves something that we think is missing in ourselves. And so because of that initial fabricated view, I need this to be happy, or I need to avoid this to maintain my happiness or safety. We're stuck in that view. We're now clinging to that view. And continued clinging is maintaining. That's all that this link tells us. From feeling as a requisite condition, from craving as a requisite condition, comes clinging and maintaining. And so now my entire existence is clinging to and maintaining those things I think that I need, no matter how much pain and suffering they might bring me, or no matter how much pleasure they may bring me, because they're both are incredibly distracting from getting at the root cause. I'm going to keep doing this because I know it keeps this away. And I'm going to keep doing this. In fact, I'm going to do as much of this other thing because it makes me feel good. And again, it doesn't always result in active substance abuse like it did in me. We can look around and everybody is involved in this in one way or another. Even if it's just being addicted to our own ideas, it's the same thing. It's still addiction. It might not manifest as quickly as alcoholism or some other addiction, but it's still the same underlying problem. You know, and I got to say here, as a recovered alcoholic and drug addict, because some people might hear this and say, well, okay, all I got to do is learn to meditate and I can resolve my addiction issues. That's not what I'm saying. And for many, many people, you need to establish sobriety first before you can even hope to develop the Dhamma. And that's not just for substance abusers. There's a talk I gave with Thane Turner is on my website called Deep Sobriety. And we go into this a little bit deeper, that any type of sobriety, whether it's from substance or anything else, that initial compulsion has to be managed. And that's not a long-term process, but it needs to be identified at some point. Sometimes the Eightfold Path can help you recognize that you're visiting. Do they still have a shopping club on TV? What are they doing now? You're visiting the shopping club too often. That's a distraction from your life. That's the same type of thing that you start to diminish. And then Dhamma practice takes you past that. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. And this is the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma and the meaning of becoming, why I named the book Becoming Buddha, Becoming Awakened. And there's some significant suttas on the meaning of becoming. There's never a qualification in the Buddha's words. In other words, becoming what? I'm going to read it again. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. That's the statement. Becoming what? In the context of what the Buddha's teaching, it's becoming further ignorant. Look at how the Buddha started. And so that's, again, that's the choice that we have in each moment. In this moment, am I going to frame my thoughts, words, and deeds by the Eightfold Path and become awakened? Or am I going to continue my ignorance and only become further ignorant? That's the meaning of becoming. From becoming further ignorant, as a requisite condition, comes birth. Again, the Buddha's teachings on physical birth are disputed here. He never concerns himself with teaching how human beings come into physical existence. Why? That's a great mystery for all of us. Human beings have been looking, where do we come from, where are we going, since the beginning of time. The Buddha didn't address it because it's simply a distraction. It doesn't relate to the Dhamma, and it doesn't relate to what's occurring. Why do we need to know how we got here? Why? As a scientist, we might want to know that. I could understand that. As someone who's hoping to understand what's occurring right here and right now, needs to understand that they're here and right now. Where I came from is a distraction from what's occurring right now, isn't it? I'm here. How do I know I'm here? Because I'm here. I don't have to describe the process of getting here. In order to sit here and teach the Dhamma, I don't have to go into intricate detail and explain to you everything I did this morning once I woke up to get here. I'm here. That's all you need to know. And you don't have to think about how I got here either, do you? I'm in front of you. That's all you need to know. Well, we are always in front of ourselves. We're always here. We can never escape ourselves unless we develop a way of looking at ourselves in relation to the world that is rooted in escape. And isn't it interesting that much of modern spirituality is rooted in that same escape? I don't want to face who I am. I don't want to address who I am and what I am in relation to the world. So let me create these very powerful, very subtle, very intricate strategies to continue that ignorance, whether it's without a so-called philosophical practice or a spiritual practice, or fully embracing some type of religion. It's all the same thing in that way, isn't it? We may be more accepting of who we are if we adopt an ideology about ourselves as Christians, as Buddhists, as Muslims, as Jews, et cetera, because it's the ideology that provides the explanation for who we are. And in fact, it provides the explanation for why we're so disappointed, even though we don't look at it that way, because it simply continues our own fabricated view of life. Again, it's what the Buddha awakened to. The world was exactly like it is today, 2,600 years ago, except for the area of communication. But we find when we look at what the Buddha did during his lifetime, that's of no benefit. It doesn't matter. The idea that gods or goddesses or one god or some type of system would provide salvation from the suffering that is inherent in having a human life, again, was just as common then as it is now. The Buddha went out seeking understanding of that and studied with all the great so-called priests and pastors and ministers of his time and realized in a completely dispassionate and impersonal way, they were simply wrong because they didn't teach him how to understand who he was in relation to the world he was living in right now. And that's what he discovered. That's the remarkable breakthrough, as he calls it, and as I call it, of how to live life as a human being. That's what he taught. He taught us how to be human beings, as opposed to this ignored view that there's something wrong or something lacking in me and I need to be more than I am in this moment, which means you just lost your life. So that's the idea. That's the idea of birth. It's not that we're creating the conditions for a physical birth. We can only do that one way, by the way. Well, we can do it medically too, but that's how human beings reproduce, only one way. I can't think myself into the next generation, even though people believe that consciousness carries creation forward. It's just ridiculous when you look at it. But what I'm giving birth to in this moment is what's important. That's what the Buddha's Dhamma resolves around. So that's what the phrasing, the using of the English word birth, which is different than the Pali word, by the way, is simply points us to that, what's occurring right now. What am I giving birth to in this moment? Not what am I giving birth to as a human species. What am I giving birth to in this moment? Because that's my experience. And if I can regain control of my mind and think within the framework of the Eightfold Path, then what I'm giving birth to in this moment is inclining my mind towards awakening. What I'm giving birth to in this moment determines what I will become in this moment. From that type of birth, as a requisite condition, comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. People can get hung up on that too. Well, isn't the Buddha describing from that birth? But remember the context. We're talking about stress arising in relation to sickness, aging, death, etc. And it's because of the reaction to first birth, to having a human life, and then reacting to sickness, reacting to aging, reacting to the fact that I'm going to die someday, reacting, and then the Buddha would continue that description, is not getting what someone wants or getting what is undesired is part of that stress and suffering. And then he concludes it by saying the five clinging aggregates of suffering. Again, describing the personal experience of suffering. In this moment, I've given birth to what I'm experiencing it. Even if in this moment, somebody comes up and slugs me in the face, and in the next moment, I'm angry and I'm ready to fight back. I'm ready to slug that guy back. That next moment is not rooted in the reality of what occurred, is it? It's my reaction to it. And so my reaction could be full of understanding. I might now be able to understand this person that just punched me has something wrong. They're mentally ill, or they're just extremely frustrated in this moment. So the proper response, the mindful response, isn't to keep the hatred going by beating the hell out of them or hoping to. The proper response is equanimity and trying to get to the understanding of what occurs. And then if in that moment I realize there's nothing that I can do, and if I stay here, I might be in danger, I move. I get out of the situation. But I've handled it mindfully, and I've handled the situation within the framework of the Eightfold Path. I haven't reacted. And again, I'm using a somewhat extreme example, but we do that all the time with things that occur that we don't like or wish was different. And in fact, it's even with the more mundane and innocuous things that keep us entrapped in this. Things that happen in that other people are doing to us, to someone who's developing the Dhamma, and other people, just earth people, if you want to use the word, we don't always react to it. So I'm using that as simply as an example. But it's the mundane things that we are constantly clinging to that maintains our ignorance, the things that we don't want to change. And they do change. Everything changes. All is impermanent. From that birth, as a requisite condition, comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. My words here. Then the Buddha describes in slightly more detail, in reverse order, each of the 12 links. But let me just go back to that. So that was the 12 links that begins in ignorance and ends up in despair, in stress and suffering, in dukkha. Excuse me. One of the things that can be confusing about that is we can try and track it too closely or be too analytical over each link in the chain. This process from ignorance to stress and suffering arises, you could say that it happens outside of time because there's not a linear progression that we can follow. I mean, sometimes you can look at it, an event, and break it down that way. Excuse me. But that from that initial ignorance, And this is something that's always going on with us as human beings. From that initial ignorance, in this moment, I can only help but create something that's going to contribute to towards my own stress and suffering. And again, it happens outside of time. We can't see it happening, but we can understand that it's happening. And when you look at this closely, I think every one of you could agree that each one of these links occurs in your life. And anytime any one of these links is recognized and dismantled or broken or cut, the whole 12-link chain of dependencies falls apart. That's why it's called dependent origination. Notice the word requisite, beginning with from ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrication. From ignorance of Four Noble Truths as the requisite condition, it's required for human beings to end up in a confused and deluded state. The fact that it happens to everyone doesn't mean that it's part of our fabric. It is now because we've created it. But each individual can change that. They can change their relationship to ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And the Buddha teaches us, again, he doesn't leave us there hanging. He tells us how to undo it. Now, the Buddha's words. Now, what is aging and death? Aging is decrepitude, brokenness, grasping, graying, decline, weakening of the faculties. Death is the passing away of the aggregates, the ending of time, the interruption in the life faculties. Why is the Buddha teaching that? He's simply teaching it as a practical teaching. This is what aging is. It's just a common human occurrence. It's the same for each and every human being. Now, what is birth? Birth is the descent, the coming forth, the coming to be. Again, he's not talking about a physical birth, is he? Birth is the appearance of the sixth sense base in relation to ignorance. The sixth sense base is now confirming my ignorance. Birth is the appearance of the sixth sense base and the five clinging aggregates. Again, we're going to talk more about this next week. But the five clinging aggregates are the personal experience of birth of ignorance taking place. It has to have a vehicle. And the vehicle that we create, we self-create, is called the five clinging aggregates. Now, what is becoming? Buddha's words here. Becoming is sensual becoming, form becoming, and formless becoming. That last could be a little bit confusing because some of you might take it, wasn't the Buddha talking about non-physical dimensions? No, he's talking about using ignorance to create the belief in speculative non-physical planes of existence. That's what the Buddha is saying is formless. It's all rooted in ignorance. It's all, and clinging to it is part of the five clinging aggregates. Some of the suttas that we'll get to, and some of the ones that we've covered, talk about that. That this thing that, this fabricated self, now called the five clinging aggregates, is constantly clinging itself to anything that maintains it. And so once it's clinged outside of itself, once my attention is stuck to something outside of where my life is occurring, there's no possible way for me to interrupt it, is there? I'm simply not here for it. It's in my mind. It's my uncontrolled or mindless mind that's driving my thoughts, words, and deeds in this moment, rather than reality. And so we can live, and we do live our whole life that way, rooted in that type of thinking, constantly reacting to what's occurring in life rather than understanding it, constantly protecting a self-referential ego personality that is insatiable, rather than simply being at peace with what's occurring. And that is what everybody wants, isn't it? When most people think about it being peaceful, they think of themselves disentangled from the world, maybe sitting in their easy chair, or maybe sitting on a beach or on a mountaintop or in their meditation chair. But almost always it's a vision of themselves disentangled from the world, the peaceful vision of self. That should tell us something, but it doesn't, does it? Because there's an underlying belief that there's something wrong with me, even that idea of sitting peacefully in my easy chair is driven by ignorance. So I need to get the softest and biggest easy chair that I can get. The hardback chair with a couple cushions isn't good enough for me anymore. Or that chair that I saw my friend, I need a bigger chair than that. And again, I'm using some silly examples that nothing, even though something might satisfy what we're looking for, it's not good enough for me right now because my mind is rooted in ignorance. There always has to be more. Now, what is becoming? Becoming is, and that's sensual becoming. Form becoming and formless becoming. I'm skipping over I skipped over a couple pages here if you're reading along. I think you are. I'm going to becoming, birth, sickness.
Okay.
Becoming, birth, sickness, old age, death, and becoming and non-becoming is the environment of dukkha caused by ignorance. The links of clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the sixth sense base, name and form, consciousness, and fabrications are all part of the process of a self arising from ignorance. This process is maintained by continued ignorance, furthering karma or kama. And we're going to get into that in 2 weeks, I think, what karma really means. The Buddha then describes how clinging to the notion of self maintains this feedback loop of senses establishing a self and maintaining the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. Wow, sleep. And what is clinging? What is clinging maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Clinging to sensual clinging to sensual stimulus, clinging to views, clinging to precepts and practices, and clinging to the doctrine of self. That's something the Buddha referenced many, many times, clinging to precepts and practices, because he noticed that many people were engaged in ritual as their way of overcoming their own ignorance, meaning a lot of praying, a lot of bowing, a lot of visualization. During the Buddha's time, a lot of sacrificing, both animals and human sacrifice. These are all precepts and practices and rituals that the Buddha realized were just rooted in ignorance, even though most of modern Buddhism is consumed by rituals and practices rather than the actual. I mean, I was involved in modern Buddhism for decades at some of the most world-renowned monasteries and some of the most world-renowned teachers, and nobody ever mentioned Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path except once in all that time. And I heard hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of Dhamma talks and meditations and all that. So I speak from that experience, which is the same experience that the Buddha had. He heard the same thing when he was out there looking. The Buddha here is cautioning against developing or maintaining practices that are given validity simply from the feeling developed or the views reinforced. And the feeling developed usually is when I start chanting or bowing or whatever it might be, I feel like I'm doing something because the motivation was that someone's noticing what I'm doing and is going to give me a reward. There can be nothing more fabricated, could there? Everything the Buddha taught is taught to be human, experienced by human beings through their own capabilities, not through supernatural imagined or fabricated capabilities. Engaging in rituals or practices that continue a doctrine of self in any realm, physical or otherwise, are also to be abandoned. The Buddha here has taken a methodical route from the ultimate unfolding of ignorance, suffering arising from birth, back to the second noble truth or the origination of dukkha, clinging. Along the way, he describes what is clung to, a self that is dependent on continued craving and continued sensory stimulus to be maintained. I'm going to stop there. Because that's enough for today, I think. Thank you for listening. Let's go online to the I'm just going to start at the top and ask if I can see you. Ask Trevor. How are you, Trevor? I think I unmuted you. No.
Yes.
There you go. Yep. Sound good.
Oh, great. So yeah, thank you so much. This is such an important chapter in the book, and I really enjoyed the chance to hear your elaboration on it today. I had a couple questions. One is, you made the point that we should recognize ourselves as a six-property human being, which that view is very compelling to me. At the same time, I've come across some suttas where it seems like the Buddha says, how could we possibly be consciousness? Because consciousness is impermanent. And how could we possibly be these properties? Because those properties come and go as well. So it seems like that's where I'm getting a little confused. Sometimes it seems like Buddha is saying, this is not self precisely because it's impermanent. So that's a bit of a...
No, I appreciate it. It's a very good question. The context is what's most important. The practical nature of the teachings in the Dhatuvibhaga Sutta is just simply to describe the makeup of every human being. But there is no personal self in that description, is there? In the four elements or the space property or the consciousness property. And then again, the relationship to consciousness is not self is also a teaching on the impermanence of consciousness, isn't it? And so he's saying like you said in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, if it's not permanent, how can we perceive it as a self, excuse me, meaning an ignorant perception of self, a perception of self rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is always towards a personal self, even if it's not recognized as self. When I see myself from a point of view of ignorance, this is the sum and substance of me. And so the Buddha is saying, just because I think that way is not true. It doesn't make it so. But that's why he's saying that consciousness is not self. He's basically saying, just because you think it doesn't mean that it's true. Frame your thinking within the framework of the Eightfold Path. And then you'll see that the most that we can claim a human being is the six property person. Because every human being is. He's not teaching that we're not humans. He's not teaching annihilation. He's not teaching nothingness. He's simply teaching a practical way of seeing ourselves in relation to the world we're living in. So
he's also not saying that it's permanent.
Yeah, nothing is permanent. So did that bring some clarity, Trevor?
That's helpful, yeah. Thank you so much, John. I'll continue to reflect on what you just shared there.
Yeah, great. Thank you for joining this morning, too. That was a great question. All right, let's see who's next.
I'll be needing to leave pretty soon.
Kevin, how are you?
Are you okay getting back up?
Thanks for asking me. Well, if you can't, I'll get a ride.
You sure?
Yeah, yeah, I'll get up there. So don't worry about it. Hold on, Kevin. Before you go, Ram, what do you have to say?
Well, it's this whole trip back through the dependent origination. It's just been wonderful.
Yeah.
What struck me last night and this morning too, when I was going back through it, is how dependent origination fits and actually drives the Eightfold Path.
Yep.
And specifically, I was looking at how right speech and right action are, you know, they're a really deceptive part of the Eightfold Path. Because from the outside, it looks like, you know, just be nice, you know, be a good person, and,
yep,
and this, you know, and you'll be fine. It's not that at all.
Right.
He sets this up so that we, you know, and he drives hard at it, that, you know, every little bit of ill will, you know, you take it away, abandon it, because, and he tells us to do that, which is a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
And you come up against this friction, and this friction where you don't want to do these nice things. That's where you get to see how dependent origination works.
Yeah.
That's how you see how,
yep,
from contact you get the feelings.
Yeah.
And I just, as before, I marvel at how he set this up.
Yeah.
How how it all fits together.
Yeah. It is. It's astonishing as you start to understand it, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and this. One sutta, and it's actually the Paticca-samuppada sutta is one of the shorter suttas,
mm-hmm,
even though it is the single most important sutta. I would say even more important than the suttas on the Four Noble Truths, mm-hmm, because not that those aren't, but it explains the problem that nobody else could ever figure out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody, you know, but the Buddha figured it out.
And
it's just this way. It's from ignorance of the way things are.
Totally radical.
Yeah.
Has been ignored ever since. And it has not been, it was radical then, it's radical now, and it's didn't get accepted then, and didn't get accepted now.
No, because it insists on recognizing the problem and ending fabricated views of self, which, again, people with more than a speck of dust in their eyes, as the Buddha said, aren't able to do that, it seems, you know, but that's just the way it is. So, yeah, great. Thank you. I will see you Tuesday. Kevin, how are you? Wait a minute.
Good time.
Kevin Hart. Mm-hmm. All right, Kevin Roach. How are you, Kevin?
Good.
It's good to
Thank
see you.
Thank you, Dan. It's really great to hear this teaching. So I'm just going to read what I wrote. It's a reflection of what you have taught us and what the Buddha has taught.
Right.
And I hope it's not too redundant.
Please.
To me, this has been one of the most difficult teachings for me to grasp. How could I memorize all the links in the right order? What if I were to miss one? Now, after reading this many times and supported by all the other teachings, it is becoming more clear. It is simply that anatta, the five clinging aggregates in the setting of ignorance and impermanence, will always continue to crave and cling, and will continue to produce suffering and stress, will continue to create dukkha. We must cease this craving, as outlined in the second and third noble truths, in order to break this chain. It is difficult to remain so vigilant over the not-self. The teaching is clearer, but the five clinging aggregates, the ego, is powerful. This is the greater difficulty. We must remain on the path. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. That was beautiful. And the five clinging aggregates are powerful, but they only are as powerful as we allow them to be. You know, that's again, that's the Eightfold Path gives us the recognition to see that each and every one of those. I can't believe it. My computer just died. Oh, well. the computer just died. So that's the end of that. Well, I lost the connection anyway, so I lost everybody. That's the way it is.
Oh.
Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, John. Well, I pulled up. I didn't see any cars. So, and then I saw the, I saw you walking in. You know, with, I read and took notes on the dependent origination and, you know, so on. And it's just a wonderful, another way of reaching acceptance.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I really think that every sutta is just, there's so many different ones, what, 100,000, you know, whatever. And yes, there's a progression, you know, to learn, but it's also circular. And I think that's been brought up before, because there are some things in it, and then, okay, well, we won't get to that till later at all. And I think they're just all connected into a whole. And it's just thinking about it and reflecting on it and reading about it is in itself, you know, just very peaceful.
Yeah, understanding. That's that. From understanding comes that peace of an awakened mind.
About it and trying to, you know, figure it out. But human beings have this urge to elaborate on things. They just can't leave something simple, not, you know, is simple-minded, you know, has a negative connotation. Oh, well, that's just too simple. It must be something more than that, you know?
No, that's the right word, too. Elaborate means that we're adding something to something because it's not good enough right now. It's the essence of fabrication.
And which is just a whole, it's explaining, too, why it's just not enough to be and to say what's around me and what I'm doing, it's all okay. This is what I'm doing now. It's like there's got to be more. We have to do something more.
Yeah.
And we're not going to be happy unless we do more.
Yep. Yeah. We even live in a society that discourages, I was going to say encourages doing more, but really discourages doing less. You always got to be doing something.
And, well, but that's capitalism.
Well, it's not just capitalism. There are people living in socialistic societies that are thinking exactly the same way. It's not a result of.
True. Capitalism is only one of the results of that.
Yeah. Well, but so is just because you brought it up, I'm not trying to get an argument. So is socialism. They're both a response to stress and suffering. You know, so that's just the way it is that dukkha occurs.
But I I mean, it's going to be a lifelong path, but I do get these sometimes, just something comes over me because something happens, and this anger.
Mm-hmm.
Like somebody doing something. Especially, you know, there's this, you know, our car culture.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many things associated with it.
Yeah. When that happens, do you notice that your anger is because you want that person to be different?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the most, it's not, and that's as far as we should go with that type of thinking. Because anything else past that point is trying to justify the way you feel, usually by blaming the other person or blaming yourself. If someone's acting in some type of hurtful way, antisocial way, pick any label you want to put on it, that's because of them. It's not because of me, and I don't have to take it personal at all. And in not taking it personal, I maintain control of my own mind. You know, but when I do take other people's actions as personal, I lose my mind. And it results in that emotions that we label as anger or frustration. And most of the time we even create phrases about justifiable anger and justifiable rage. It's never justifiable. It's one thing to say that there's something that's occurring in the world and that would be skillful if it wasn't occurring. There's a lot of things like that. But the understanding is it's occurring in the world because it's occurring in the world, not something inherently wrong with other people, because there's my judgment.
Mm-hmm. So that's what happened to me and what happens sometimes. Okay, so it was in a parking lot. There are, you park, and then they have a place where there's white lines for crossing. And if someone's crossing, you're supposed to stop and wait. So this woman, just completely oblivious, you know, to the fact that we were there and pulled into our spot. And so just something wells up, mm-hmm. like, you know, very, very negative. But I feel that because of this, the practice and just the continuation of thinking and reading, just it passed.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened, but it passed, and I sort of totally forgot about it until I'm just using as an example. You know, like, I want to go over and say, you know, you almost ran me down. Well, you're supposed to be walk defensive, you know, we're supposed to live defensively too, and all that. And, you know, you're an idiot, and, you know, all kinds of other
things. Yeah. So the third factor of the Eightfold Path cleared it all up for you, didn't it? Right speech. And the framework, you might not have exactly thought about right speech, but it was a framework of the Eightfold Path that you have developed over time that allowed you to do that instead of reacting or going up and giving people a piece of my mind. You know, people don't need a piece of my mind. I should keep it to myself. And thank you, Lisa. That is, you're describing developing the Dhamma and its practical applications. It's just that way. The Buddha described the quality of an awakened human being's mind as calm and at peace. That's what you're describing. Despite someone almost driving over you, you maintain, at least you were able to regain a calm and peaceful mind. That's Dhamma practice.
Well, yes, and when you think about it, we can be so much happier that way. You know, why live?
Yeah. Why do I want to be angry about that?
Of anger and resentment, yeah. You know, they reside in us, and is that making us happier to be that way? But
I don't want it.
But I know, but society is just destroying itself.
Well, but let society do it, Lisa. That's the point. The Buddha awakened to, after this, I'm going to give a talk on the three suttas on becoming. And one of them, the Loka Sutta, the Buddha described it this way, just to post his awakening. He said, I looked out on the world and the world was aflame. Aflame with what? Aflame with the fires of passion. What he was talking about is human beings rooted in greed and aversion and deluded thinking. Exactly the same as what's occurring right now. So society is society. Society is the world. When we're saying, why does society do this? We know the answer. Society acts this way. The structures that have been built up in human society are this way because of ignorance. Not because that some person needs to change their own outward expression of ignorance. People need to change ignorance, but they're not likely to. So the only thing that I can do in response to the ills of the world, the most reasonable and practical thing I can do is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because the ills of the world are going to continue no matter what I think. We have been trying to stop the same things in human behavior since the beginning of human behavior. And we haven't made a dent in it. We haven't, we've made some practical developments. We haven't blown ourselves off the planet yet. And I think that, or I really believe that. I'm not saying this jokingly. That's an accomplishment that we haven't done that yet. But we're still killing each other every day. I think you weren't here for a couple of classes ago. I said something that the first time that one human being killed another human being, we should have realized the error of our ways, the error of our own ignorance. But that didn't inform anybody, did it? We just keep doing it. And then people say, oh, that's so terrible that people are doing that and people are acting that way. And there's racism and poverty and misogyny and xenophobia. There's all these terrible things that we have wonderful labels for. But nobody comes up with this with the practical solution. I'm concerned about the condition of the world. I'm concerned about the hatred in the world. You know what I do about it? Is I go home and meditate and I develop the Dhamma so that I don't become further hateful. So that I don't contribute to what's wrong in the world. Because that's the only thing that can make a difference. And so give yourself a lot of credit for doing the one thing that may make a difference. At the very least, it'll make a difference to you and the people that you come in contact with. Thank you. Good morning, Justin. Welcome to our Sangha. And what do you think? You don't have to answer. You can tell me whatever you want to say or nothing.
No, I love it. That's interesting because that's an external way of bringing up and working on your practice, right?
Yep.
But I came here to see Matt because I was suffering from internal emotions.
Yep.
Mostly jealousy. When I was, as a child, I was abused by my mother, and when it comes to relationships, I immediately go to jealousy. As soon as I meet someone, it possesses my mind, and it makes me suffer greatly.
Can I ask you a question? Not only because I notice some people get jealousy and envy mixed up. So you're describing suspiciousness towards someone, that their behavior.
It's the idea of any past partners or relationships I obsess over. And I find myself in relationships, like currently I'm in a relationship with someone who's separated, still married. So that other person is still in the house or in their life.
Yeah.
So that other person is a threat to what I think I want or need to get, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know, I'm doing this out of desperation because life is no longer fun or fulfilling if my mind is always distracted by a feeling
Absolutely.
Of jealousy.
Yep.
So I am here because I'm at the, you know, I'm suffering. And I see how this could be the key to undoing that suffering. But I struggle with the, you know, I'm 44. I know that's not old, but for 44 years, that structure of my personality feels like it's a bunch of knots mm-hmm. that are tied together. And everything I do is about clinging and craving.
Yep.
I'm always trying to get away from that feeling of loneliness and abandonment and all the abuse that I experience. And I know that's my story. I know that Matt talked about that I carry this story around of my mother trying to kill me, you know, all these things that happened to me. And I don't want to carry that around.
Yep.
I'd love to be free and accept the moment, but I have substances that I, like you said, I do chase because they made me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it medicine.
Yep.
But it's actually distracting me. So I guess what I'm really trying to figure out is, what comes first, the feeling or the thought? Because the feeling makes me think a thought, and the thought keeps that feeling going for a long time.
I don't mean to cut you off. What does it matter if it's a feeling or a thought?
I can't figure out. So when I breathe into the feeling, because I you know.
I'm going to stop you there. What do you mean by breathing into the feeling?
Well, I try not to let it make me want to run or, you know, cling to something.
Now, again, I don't mean to interrupt you. What you're doing in that instance is giving a feeling that is fabricated. It's like foam on the ocean. You're increasing its hold over you by the notion that you have to address it in some way other than just take a breath. And that's it. Feelings are impermanent. Thoughts are impermanent. They arise and pass away of their own accord unless we cling to them.
Yeah.
So you, again, this is a typical stress response that you create a scenario in your mind that replays the stressor over and over and over again.
Yeah.
It sounds like you don't want to do that, but that's where you're being irresponsible towards yourself. And that's, but the part of you that's responsible for yourself is now here today.
Yeah.
You want to address this in a way. So this begins the process. The Dhamma, let me go back what you're experiencing is common. Everybody's going through it. Not everybody has had the same abuse as you had, but having a human life, when you really look at the description of having a human life, while different situations are more extreme for certain people, stress is stress. And when I look out on other people, I see a very common PTSD response. And I don't want to get into exactly what that is, but we all know what it is.
Yeah.
The defining characteristic of that, though, is everything is personal. Everything
That's
is
right.
happening to me.
That's right.
That's what the Buddha addressed. So the point I'm making is the response, the PTSD response, is more severe in some people,
yeah.
usually based on experience, but not always. But it's the same underlying problem. So you're taking things too personal. The solution is to stop taking things so personally. And what you began here today will do just that.
Okay.
One sitting, one class is probably not going to end it, but I bet you very quickly, if you continue with this practice, I would be surprised if you came back in 2 weeks and said you don't see things differently and you don't feel differently. That will entail starting a meditation practice. You say you've been meditating now for a little while?
Yeah, I saw Matt and he did acupuncture on me and it all went away. I felt that peace and I felt that centeredness. Now, he was talking about all of this as he was doing the needle, you know. So I was literally feeling myself being reprogrammed energetically and him speaking all of these, you know, for my first time hearing all of this stuff, which was really resonating.
With yeah.
That there is a peace coming if I continue. That's why
yeah.
I will continue to come. I have your book. He gave, you know, I got that and I've been reading that and doing meditation 2 or 3 minutes a day, twice a day.
Oh,
you know?
I was going to say, that's perfect. If you want to slowly increase it to 5 minutes twice a day, and then again, gradually add time where you can even talk to me about when you should add time. That you're going to start feeling some wonderful benefits from it, Justin. You
know, and I would love to, it's Dustin with a D.
Dustin.
Everybody calls me Justin, but it's, and I would love to, like, you know, the clinging, like, I use marijuana, right? That's how I think I feel better.
Yep.
But now I see that I'm clinging to that because it takes me out of that moment when
yep.
I might feel overwhelmed with loneliness or jealousy. It completely distracts me.
But that's
from
the point.
That moment.
But you're
that,
not doing
I can
it.
Do that with meditation, right? Like that, when I do that substance, it changed it, those impermanent thoughts. It just assists me with not staying in one, right? It kind of takes
yeah.
me to another level of not a non-thinking. But the meditation, and if I continue this meditation, will the clinging to things like that sort of dissipate? Like I felt when I left here, I didn't want it.
It will, but it won't if you keep, and I'm not telling you not to smoke marijuana.
Yeah.
But it won't if you keep smoking marijuana. It's just the way it is. So, and again, I'm careful. Don't take that as a condemnation. If you
yeah.
keep coming here for the next 10 years and every day you say, guess what? I smoked a joint before I came in. I'll tell you to have a seat.
Yeah.
But I'll also tell you that if you want to develop the full path, it's best to not do that. Because you're every time you smoke a joint, you're undoing everything you've done up to that point. You're saying, I don't want to be here.
Right.
I don't want to be here.
Okay.
Where the Dhamma is really gets to the point where you're telling yourself, I want to be here because this is where my life is.
Yeah.
And I've overcome some pretty severe addiction. So that's why I'm just as a consequence, if you've been smoking a lot of pot and every day, it's probably best for you to cut down until you finally stop.
Yeah.
And again, if you want to and have a conversation with me about that, I'm happy to do that.
I love
but
that.
You're in the right place. There was a time in my life that I was drinking 2 quarts of vodka every day, smoking, you know, probably 10 or 15 joints, putting stuff in my nose, once in my veins. And I was just out of my mind. And I was able to overcome that, which is remarkable to me. But when I finally overcame it, looking back on it, that was not a big deal either. You know, it's a big deal going through getting off of anything. If you drink 20 cups of coffee a day and you cut out, you're going to miss it. So you're going to miss it a little bit. But that uncomfortability is part of craving. You can get a good understanding of what craving really is when you decide now it's time to smoke a joint and no, I'm not going to do it. And so go ahead and feel craving and clinging.
I even feel craving for the jealous thoughts.
Yeah, because they're familiar to you, don't you? That's you. You are jealous Dustin. And that's not for me to say. That's what you think of yourself.
Yeah.
And so, of course, you're going to keep falling back into that. It's just familiar. But
I'm also taking things personal, right? That's
everything. So, but that's common too, Dustin. You'll, again, continue with this practice. I would bet you would already say that you've depersonalized things at least a little bit.
Yeah, 100%. This worked right away. It was the exact thing that was causing me suffering.
So you're
thinking, self-centered thinking, you know, like that's what Matt was pointing out. He was like, you have it. And it's true. And I hide behind all my identities and everything that I have.
Everybody does. I think you said you're 3 weeks into the book.
Yeah.
All right, continue to just catch up. You know, the talks are online too from each class.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, if you go on becoming-buddha.com, have you been to the website?
No.
Ah, becoming-buddha.com. Scroll down on the homepage. You'll see 2020, I think, Truth of Happiness Sangha Dhamma Study. Click on that. It'll take you to the page where all the past talks are.
Okay.
And so you can catch up that way.
So I can go through the first three chapters?
Oh, yeah. Look, there's talks for every class we've given so far.
Great.
So right now there's... And most of the talks... In other words, the same subject was taught on a Tuesday and a Saturday. Most of the talks are different. One or two of them, I think, are on the same subject, but they're just an expansion. So if you want to, there's 15 now. Take your time, but I would say go back and listen to those, and you'll be caught up with us.
Yeah.
Probably before we finish, but even if not, that's okay. The important thing is be very gentle with yourself. Be gentle with the people you're jealous about. I mean, try to think about that. And just use a strong word. When hatred comes up about someone that you're feeling jealous about, take a breath and let that person go. And I'm not saying don't get into you're wrong for thinking that way or anything like that. Just take a breath, let it go, and bring yourself back into your body and keep coming to class, and you'll have these benefits. So
I appreciate
it. Good for you. I'm glad you're here. I wish that didn't happen, but we'll finish as we usually do with metta. So these are the Buddha's words. Metta means loving kindness. These are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. And we always finish our class with this. So again, just find your meditative posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Namaste.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.